Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. And we're also pleased to have back Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, clinical assistant professor at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. And for quite a long time now, he's been stopping by regularly, always on a Thursday, once a month, to do these shows on children's health. A long time ago, we decided that this was one of those things that people would always have questions about, and we thought it would be a good idea to have a regular visit with the pediatrician so that people could call in and ask questions. And we're wide open to whatever might interest you or whatever might be worrying you right at the moment, as long as it's the kind of thing you could imagine talking about with the pediatrician. Could be some kind of illness issue. We've talked a lot about your basic childhood diseases. We've talked about coping with your common bumps and bruises. We've talked about nutrition, diet, eating problems. We've talked about sleep problems. We've talked about developmental issues, any and all of that stuff. You're certainly welcome here on the program, and all you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use that number, and we will pay for the call, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Welcome back.
Well, good morning, and it's good to be back. How are things? Especially on this beautiful morning.
It's pretty nice. It's 49 degrees, and the sun is out, and you better enjoy it, because it sounds like tomorrow's not going to be so nice, and Saturday even less nice, but then Sunday not so bad, and we seem to be in this strange sort of cycle of going back between weather that feels like winter and weather that feels like, I don't know, spring.
But no blizzard yet.
No weather. No, yeah, fortunately not yet. Although I think I heard one of our weather guys, Mike Sola, the other day talking about the long-range forecasts, and whatever, however much faith you want to put in those, saying that the weather pattern for the month of February could be back to very wintry, like we had in December. So don't put away your long underwear and your boots and your heavy coats, because you're probably going to need them again. So up and down, never can tell. Let me see. What was I? No, I was going to ask you about something. I'm not sure now. Yes, I know what it was. What's the news about flu? Have we been seeing flu? I don't recall having read too much about serious numbers of flu around the country.
I haven't. You know, I haven't either. And I saw, I think it was in the New York Times, where they said that the anti-flu medications apparently aren't effective against the current flu going around. But again, I've not heard anything about a tremendous amount of flu going around. So it looks like this winter, and it's, you know, we're middle of January already. If we haven't seen a lot of flu, probably, I don't guarantee this, but probably this isn't going to be a bad flu year again.
Well, that would be okay. And last year, when there was all this concern about not having enough vaccine, it turned out to be not such a bad year. So that worked out nicely. Maybe then again we'll be lucky, then it won't be all that much.
Yeah, just don't kiss a chicken. Just
no matter how you feel about it.
Yeah, you can eat them, but cook them and eat them, but
don't kiss a chicken. Otherwise, what do you want to talk about?
Circumcision. Yesterday, a friend asked me, she has two sons, and I presume they are both circumcised because of the question she asked. Her brother just had a boy and elected not to have him circumcised, and that's sort of strange. What risk, why did he do this, and what risk is he putting his son at? And my answer is, circumcision is a completely elective procedure, and do it if you want, and don't do it if you don't want. And as far as I know, the United States and the Jewish Israel, where most of people are Jewish and it's in part of their religion to be circumcised, do it, and none of the rest of the world does. And I think it's mostly complete elective procedure. What reasons do we have to circumcise? I suppose if you want a reason, there is a slightly increased incidence of sexually transmitted diseases and penile cancer in those people at risk for sexually transmitted diseases in the first place if they're uncircumcised. That is, if they have multiple sexual partners. But outside that, for the average person, there's no reason to circumcise a boy or not. It's elective. If you want it done, do it. And if you don't want to do it, don't do it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that when we were babies that it was just – there was no question. You just did it. Everybody did it. And now it seems that during the time that you and I have been having these talks, there more people are raising the question, do we need to do this? Should we do this? And so at least it's being talked about. Do you have any sense of whether, in fact, the numbers of circumcisions in the United States has it gone down? Are there now more baby boys that aren't circumcised than there were 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago?
Yeah, I think there are, but I think the percentage change has been kind of pretty much insignificant.
Not all that dramatic. Yeah. Okay. Very good. So again, your bottom line is that basically this is a cosmetic issue, and that if you want to have your boy circumcised, you'd say okay. If you decide not to, you'd say okay.
Okay.
It's kind of, and I think the only thing that we've talked about is, and this may be something you want to think about, is dad circumcised, and then is that going to be an issue for you that you want the boy and dad to look the same, or maybe you say, well, that's just not that important, and it's not.
Yeah, and generally, my experience has been, it really isn't. It doesn't seem to be a major. I've asked uncircumcised boys in my practice, did you have trouble in the locker room or in the shower after PE or after football with being uncircumcised? And the answer was universally, nobody said anything.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Yeah, just not the kind of thing you're going to be discussing probably one way or another. Yeah, okay. Well, we have someone here to talk with, someone in Champaign. We'll do that. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I wanted to add some amendments to your comments about circumcision. First is that the whole Muslim world circumcises.
Okay.
So that's an increase of
a bunch.
A billion. Billions of people?
Yeah.
Okay, let's that's male and female, so you got to cut that in half. Anyway, you figure the numbers.
Okay.
The second thing is that I believe that the literature now shows that there's significant differences in AIDS infection in Africa between those that are circumcised and those that aren't, significant differences. And that's it's even been considered as a preventative in Africa.
Yeah.
For those who don't. And it's a major fact. And if it's in Africa, then it'll be, of course, in other parts of the world where there isn't that distinction, because in Africa there are groups that do and groups that don't because of traditional reasons.
Yeah. There is a statistically significant increase in sexually transmitted diseases in the uncircumcised. That space behind the foreskin tends to harbor these things. And again, in this country, it'd be mainly in those that are at risk for sexually transmitted diseases in the first place. That is, those who have multiple sexual partners.
Well, except in Africa, we're talking about a major plague that's killing a large percentage of the population. And we will similarly be facing the same issues in Asia. So for something that's fairly easy and if done at a certain time in life and that makes a significant difference in life and death matters, which is what AIDS is in large parts of the world, I think at least there needs to be at least further exploration of it. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. When a circumcision is done, do they use anesthetic?
Local anesthetic,
They do, okay.
Yeah. That works pretty well.
Yeah. So it's not something that I remember particularly, but I guess I have they always done that?
No. That's probably within the last 20 years or so, where we used a dorsal penile block, or actually a variety of things are used. And they're looking at simple things like sucrose. You give the baby a nipple to suck on with cotton saturated in a sugar solution, and apparently that seems to help too. And I think maybe what we're dealing with is newborn infant is not neurologically mature yet. I think there's no doubt they, you know, when we were doing circumcisions without anesthetic, there's no doubt in my mind that they felt it.
Yeah.
But they seem to, as soon as you were done with the procedure, which really doesn't take very long, it's a matter of less than 5 minutes, you know, as soon as you were done messing around, they didn't react. Yeah, they'd settle back down and suck their nipple and go back to sleep again. Yeah.
And now that you mention it, I think that I just did see some article the other day about some research that they had done with babies that shows that if you give them a taste of a little something sweet before you do some procedure that's going to annoy them, like stick them with a needle to give them a shot, that it actually, it seems to... I'm not sure what they seem to react. The reaction is a little bit better. Yeah. Maybe they don't cry as much. They don't scream as much.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that if they understand what really is going on there, if it just gives them something a little pleasant to focus on right before you do the unpleasant thing.
Yeah. Because, they've done studies and they've videotaped them and looked at grimaces and that sort of thing. And I think they still haven't figured out is there an anesthetic in sucrose? Or are we just, we playing psychological games on them? And I don't, but again, if it works, why not?
I would be guessing that more it is a psychological game and it's not that it has any sort of pain relieving properties. Maybe it just gives you something else to think about. And it's nice and your brain says, oh, that's nice. And so that the other reaction that says, oh, what are you doing to me? What are you sticking me with that needle for? It doesn't somehow have as much impact them.
And I think, again, we're dealing with an immature brain that's not myelinized the way ours is. And maybe they perceive pain? Absolutely. Maybe they perceive it in a little different way, or maybe they don't remember it. So as soon as the painful stimulus is gone, it's gone and they're happy.
But at least it seems like we've come around some. Was it not the case that there was some point where it was argued that babies didn't feel pain?
Yeah. When I was trained, babies don't feel pain. Yes. So just go ahead and do it. Whatever you need to do, go ahead and do it. And it's okay. And you say, you know what? I know that's not true, because when I stuck that baby for a blood draw, or when I stuck that baby for an IV, or when I did that circumcision or whatever I did, that baby was unhappy. It might not have been for very long, but that baby was unhappy. And this stuff that they don't feel pain is obviously not true.
So you and like other doctors and med students were being told this one thing, and yet here in your practice you were saying, no, wait a minute, that's not true.
Then we did tongue clippings too for tongue tie.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a medical student procedure. Uh-huh. And you were supposed to clip the frenulum, that little flap of skin under the tongue. Yeah. And you said, wait a minute, this baby's crying. This tongue is going all over the place. And you're in there with a pair of scissors, and you're supposed to clip this thing, and you say, I don't want to do a glossectomy. I don't want to take the whole tongue out. So what you did is you never closed the scissors, and you just kept the blade open a little bit till you got a little bit of blood, made the frenulum a little bit raw on you. Then you told the resident, I did it. I did it. And probably, it was something that didn't need to be done anyway.
So those babies were all just perfectly fine. They did not have problems later with their speech or anything. Yeah.
No. Well, we've done it. I think medicine's changed a lot. We're not doing a lot of things that we used to do that we thought were sort of the gospel, and they weren't. And kids do perfectly well without being interfered with.
Well, if you have questions about your children or the children in your life, give us a call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bochak. He's a pediatrician and for a long time has been with us here once a month, always on a Thursday, for this regular program on children's health. Here's something that we came across. We always out there looking for information that we could talk about. Here's a story that, according to a study from the American College of Chest Physicians, they apparently have decided that for children, over-the-counter cough medicines don't do anything. Maybe if you're an adult and you've tried them, maybe you'd say, well, I know that they don't do anything. And that makes you wonder if you have, whether you're an adult or a child, and you have the common cold symptoms, you're all congested, and particularly if you have a cough and I know this from experience. It can be a real bear at night, and if you can't sleep, that you get into a bad situation. So you go down there and you go to the store, and there is an enormous rack of stuff.
Not anymore, because it's behind the counter.
Oh, well, yes. The decongestants, yes. You have to have a note. You have to have permission. But, you know, other kinds of these medicines with various kinds of combinations of things to treat different kinds of symptoms. And so you stand there and you look all this stuff and you think, well, what do I need? Is this going to work? And it sounds like we've talked about this before. I've talked about this with other doctors that, you know, there's sometimes you can get a little bit of symptom relief, but it's generally not terribly dramatic. And particularly, though, when you're dealing with kids, what would you suggest parents think about?
I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't spend my money on it. Because they do, I kind of sort of disagree with the American College of Chest Physicians. They do work in the sense that they will keep these kids zipped up because they tend to be stimulants too. So maybe they won't sleep. But yeah, the studies I've seen are sort of mixed whether they really reduce resistance through the nose. But I think most of the studies agree that they probably don't do a whole lot as far as relieving the symptoms. And so I probably wouldn't waste my money on them. And I think the other concern is, I think we've read about acetaminophen, Tylenol, and liver disease. And a lot of these products throw acetaminophen in there for reasons they've never been perfectly rational to me. So I think, again, check your medicines that you're giving your child. Do they work? And what hidden ingredient is in there that I'm really not looking for?
Yeah, I think you're pointing to a good thing that there's this, people are particularly cautioned that if you're taking one of these combination medicines that has acetaminophen in it, don't then take Tylenol in addition to that, because what you're doing is you may be doubling, increasing the dose of that. And if you do that enough, then it can have these potential liver problems, which you don't want to get into. So just
Child has a cold and the stuffy nose and you believe in a decongestant, use a pure decongestant. If your child has a cold and a fever, then give them a decongestant and give them Tylenol. But don't give them a combination. Yeah, like you said, don't give them a combination thing and then give them acetaminophen on top of it. Because, your dose kind of mounts up.
Yeah. Okay. We have some other callers here. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question, a little different. My daughter is 13 years old, and she had gastritis since 6 years ago and a lot of gastrointestinal problems. The thing is now she is eating too much, and she's very self-conscious. She's like 175 pounds or something around that. And the doctors, normally we ask about diet. She asks about diet, and they say, no, she's too young for diet. She even asked me about pills, and I don't want to give her pills because, I don't know, she's taking another medicine, and I am afraid about will be a problem. So I would like to know your opinion and advice about what we can do in her case. Now, she doesn't want to exercise because she's tired all the time, I suppose, because of so much food. We try very hard, and she's developing another problem, like sometimes making throw up herself or cut herself. And that is a big problem. She's with a psychiatrist now because she's cutting her wrist, and it's all about she's hungry. She's hungry all the time, and we say, no, you can eat right now. Oh, my God, she make a big problem and is so miserable that she even go and cut herself. I have all the nice hiding in the house. That is my question.
Okay. She deserves to be under psychiatric care.
Yes.
There's no doubt about that. She needs to be encouraged to be active, to use some calories that way. And how does she look weight-wise?
She's big. She's very, very fat, but she's chubby. And she's in middle school, so very self-conscious right now about classmates and, you know, make fun, things like that.
Okay. Has she always been chubby, or is this relatively recent?
Oh, no, that is recently, like the last 2-3 years. She was very skinny. She was always thin, even with
everything. part of it may be puberty.
Yeah.
Part of it may be puberty. No, I don't think she's not too young to diet in the sense of what foods does she like to eat?
Oh, she likes everything.
Yeah. You know, I think in she likes everything, but does she crave cookies and sweets and that sort of stuff?
She prefers salty things like
potato chips.
Snacks and potato chips and
Fritos.
Things like that. But she's good with veggies, with everything. I never had a problem that she don't like.
Okay.
Nothing like that.
You know what I think? Since you're the grocery shopper, limit what you have at home. Don't buy Fritos. Don't buy potato chips.
Okay.
Don't buy that stuff. Don't have it available at home. Yeah, can she go out and get it herself? Yeah, but she probably won't as much. How does she do as far as soft drinks are concerned?
How she do what?
Does she like soft drinks a lot?
Oh, she does, but no. No, she drinks a lot more water than anything else.
Good. Okay.
I don't know much about soft drinks.
Okay, good, because water doesn't have any calories in it. That's fine.
Yes, my main concern is if we deny some and she's hungry, then she do things against herself very bad. Oh. I know she's now like more than a year with a psychiatrist, but we don't see any improvements, and she keep getting bigger and bigger. And if we mention, say, oh, you don't accept me, well, how I am. So we can even mention about you're getting heavier or, you know, because she feels we don't like her.
Yeah. Have you talked to the psychiatrist about how to handle her?
She just gave us medicine. No more advices. I mean, she's taking something called Abilify.
I think I would talk to the psychiatrist and say, what can I deprive her of? What's going to happen if I just don't have this food available around the house?
Yes.
And I think that would be my thrust. Just don't have that food available.
Okay.
Yeah, she's going to, you know what, if she's just going to be an eater and wants to substitute vegetables fruits or vegetables for potato chips and those kind of snacks, she's still going to be better off.
Yes.
Because she's going to have less fat in her diet, she's going to cut her calorie intake down, without cutting the volume of food down as much. And I think she'll still be better off.
Okay.
But I think I would talk with her psychiatrist, her counselor, and say, you know, this is the problem we're having at home. If I do this, this is what I've been thinking about doing, or this is what it's been suggested by me or grandmother or whatever. What do you think, if I do this, is this a good idea or is this a bad idea?
Okay, I will ask her. I'm the psychiatrist, and I really appreciate your comments and your help.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
We're at our midpoint here. This is the monthly show that we do on children's health. Dr. Robert Bocek is our guest. He's a pediatrician, clinical assistant professor at the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign, and monthly he's been stopping by here for quite a while to talk about children's health and give people a chance to call in here, ask questions. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Lawrence County and on our toll free line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This may be related to children's health, but do you ever have any occasion of adults having whooping cough?
Good question. Yes. Boy, thank you. I'm glad you brought this up. Yes, we've talked about this before, that the last dose of pertussis is given about kindergarten age. About age 5, and the reason it stopped at that time is the side effects. As we get older, we tolerate pertussis vaccine, whooping cough vaccine, less and less well. We have more and more side effects, more and more sore arms, so it just has not been given since then. So we've got the immunity to the vaccine lasts, about 7 years, plus or minus. So by age 12, all of us are susceptible to pertussis or whooping cough. So we've got this large reservoir out in the world that's susceptible to pertussis or whooping cough. In the age group, it tends to be not a serious disease, but a kind of a vexing disease. We have this prolonged cough for 6 weeks or so. But the other problem along with this is we are a source of infection to unimmunized infants or young infants, where it is more of a problem. That's where the mortality, morbidity is. Those are the, that's the age group that gets hospitalized. That's the age group that may die of the disease. We've had an acellular pertussis vaccine with a much lower incidence of side effects for several years to be used in the age group that was getting pertussis vaccine. We now have it for adults, and in fact, the current recommendation is coming out that all teenagers be immunized with the acellular pertussis component of the vaccine. So instead of getting a small DT every 10 years, you will get a small D acellular PT vaccine. So hopefully in the future, we will be immunizing all adults with the acellular pertussis vaccine, which has a much lower reaction rate. So adults won't be getting pertussis, and the reservoir of the source of pertussis for the young children will be eliminated.
Well, the symptoms in an adult would be mostly just a cough and...
Just a prolonged cough and cold.
Uh-huh. You know, a real dry cough or...
Could be a real dry cough. Yeah, adults do not whoop.
Uh-huh.
They do not cough and cough and cough and have that whoop in the way children do. So, yeah, they won't have the they won't have the suggested, they won't have whooping, the whooping cough.
Uh-huh. Do they have, is temperature or fever related? Or?
They may. Early on in the course of the illness, they may.
Uh-huh.
The other problem with whooping cough is antibiotics are effective in cutting down the time that we can, that the person who has whooping cough can transmit it, but that doesn't seem to change the course of the disease. So you'll cough just as long. You just won't cough out the bacteria and give it to me or somebody else, but you'll still cough just as long. So, yeah, we don't have good treatment. We have good treatment to break the transmissibility of the disease, but we don't have treatment that will affect the course of the disease.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Right, thanks for the call. So now what adults should expect is if they're on the regular schedule of getting boosters like they're supposed to, that in addition to having a tetanus and diphtheria every 10 years, there's also going to be the pertussis in there.
Maybe. I don't think that's officially recommended yet, but that may be coming.
Okay.
If they're doing it for teenagers, I suspect it's going to sneak into the adult years.
Yeah. So that eventually, again, if people are getting their updates like they should, eventually then every 10 years, everybody is going to get that.
I hope.
The idea is that then we're hoping that adults then won't get it. And it's the issue is that it's not all that serious in adults, but we don't want adults getting it and then passing it on to the
at-risk. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers you want to give us a call. Something else here also, just and I know that we've mentioned this before, but apparently now the Academy of Pediatrics, American Academy of Pediatrics, is also recommending now the meningitis vaccine for teenagers, essentially, and for college freshmen who will be living in a dormitory in those situations where people are going to have a bunch of people living together in close proximity where the possibility of catching the disease is greater just because people are sort of crowded in. And we have in recent years, every once in a while, you hear about a little bit of an outbreak at some university campus, and I think now we're finally to the point where we're just saying, well, maybe we should just all the kids who are going into the dormitories should just get the shot.
Yeah, I don't fully understand this. I fully support this vaccine. This is a relatively new vaccine, and again, it's a protein conjugate vaccine, so it's much more effective than the vaccine we had, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, which was not conjugated. This is a much better vaccine. I guess, again, I'd like to see every teenager get this. And maybe I'd like to see, we tend to have two P peaks during our lifetime of meningococcal disease. One is late teenagers, early adulthood, and one is, I believe it's about age 3 years or so. And I'd like to see, and research is going on now to see if this vaccine is safe and effective to give to infants, and maybe we'll give it to the infant and not worry about the teenager because we'll have given it to the infant and it'll still be in effect.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that here now, I guess the Academy has put out a new schedule for immunizations, and it also includes, and I don't know if this is something that's new now, also hepatitis A vaccine for infants, all infants a year to between 1 year and 2 years old, I guess. Is that something that's new?
The vaccine is not new. I don't know how old that is. I think that's about a decade old or so. But the universal recommendation is new. Mm-hmm. It was for those people at high risk, those people who lived in endemic areas or were going to endemic areas to visit, and now it's universal. Hepatitis A, again, is, if you got to get hepatitis, I think that's the one you want to get. You know, it may make you sick, although most people who get it aren't symptomatic. It's very, very, as compared to hepatitis B and C, it is very unlikely to kick the liver in a permanent way, to cause any permanent liver damage, or to make you into a carrier. So, if you have to get a hepatitis A is a nice one to get. All if right. You have to get it.
But in any case, now the recommendation is for infants to get it, for all of them to get it. Right. Has the standard list changed all that much? I know we've talked about over time various things that have gotten added. We now have that. We have the chickenpox vaccine. You know, there's some other things that have been added over time. How much from, say, you know, go back 20...
Go back to my original training.
Go back to when your original training. How much has the list of standard childhood immunizations grown?
When I was first in practice, the measles vaccine was just being toyed with. What's the optimum age to give it? Do you give it with gamma globulin and that sort of thing? Rubella was sort of a... German measles was sort of, you want it or don't you want it? And mumps was sort of left out. And Haemophilus influenza B didn't exist. Polio certainly existed. But yeah, I think that was about it. The DPT and the polio. And the measles, mumps, and German measles vaccine was first coming out. And that was about 30 years ago. So we've come a long ways. And, we've really knocked the daylights out of meningitis in kids, again, with the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine. We've converted, that caused, I think, about 15,000 cases a year of meningitis in kids. A good proportion of them had hearing damage or something afterwards. And now meningococcemia, I think, has come into the number one position as the cause of meningitis with 1,500 cases a year instead of 15,000 cases a year. Although, again, if I had to have one or the, I'd rather have Haemophilus influenza B meningitis than meningococcal meningitis because I may not hear afterwards, but I'm probably going to survive it. Whereas the mortality rate is much higher with meningococcal disease. But again, we just talked about the vaccine for that coming out. And so hopefully we'll be able to knock the socks off, eliminate that disease too. Now, then what we have to deal with is the sexually transmitted diseases. And unfortunately, actually, I think those are down some too in this country.
Yes.
Again,
yes.
We've got a big problem in especially with HIV in Africa, Asia, and my understanding is Russia has a significant problem with it too.
Well, I know that now there's research going on for a vaccine for some of the more common and problematic forms of the human papilloma virus, which is thought to be implicated in some cervical cancers, that it may well be that that's going to become a standard sort of thing that I guess one of the questions is, well, when do you get
when do you do that?
That maybe at the point where you think someone is going to become sexually active, so I don't know what age you peg that at, 15, 16, 17, 18, 20, I don't know.
Who knows?
But, you know, somewhere in that area, that no doubt is going to become, it seems likely to expect that there will be a time that that's going to become a standard thing that's recommended. And if there are others developed, I suppose that there may be additions to that list.
And sexually transmitted diseases, I mean, to avoid them, we're not talking about becoming a shaker, you know? The key seems to be how many sexual partners people have. The more sexual partners you have, the more you're likely to pick up a sexually transmitted disease. So I don't know what you're going to do. That's the facts, folks.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician, and he's with us here once a month, always on a Thursday, and we talk about children's health. We have about 12, 13 minutes left here in the program, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We were talking a little bit before things got going, is that you were thinking about we were talking a little bit about environmental pollutants and particularly lead, I guess, which is something that certainly in the past there has been a lot of concern about lead in the environment for a number of reasons, including the fact that it's persistent and hangs around for a long time. And it's something that I think we've made some progress in dealing with, getting it out of gasoline and getting it out of paint. Is there still the worry about the potential kids and their potential exposure to lead?
Yeah, and I think De Beers says diamonds last forever. Well, actually, I found out you can burn a diamond. It's made out of carbon, so under the right circumstances, you can burn a diamond. But lead probably doesn't last forever. We've come a long ways. I think when I was in training, again, when the blood lead level got to be above 40, we began to worry because at 65 or so, you start chelating and getting rid of it. But now what we're finding is that even low blood lead levels probably have an effect on are toxic mainly to the central nervous system. And kids with blood lead levels of 5 or 10 may not be as functioning as well as they could if blood lead levels were zero. And our body, it needs trace amounts of copper, it needs trace amounts of manganese, it needs trace amounts of a lot of stuff, but it doesn't need any lead in it. And there is lead in our environment, and it does sort of last forever. If you're living in an old house built before, I forget, 1970s, all lead disappeared from paint somewhere in there, you've still got lead in your house. If you've got a good coat of paint over it, fine. It's pretty much locked up. If your child, if you got any peeling paint and that sort of stuff, it's in there. And probably in the carpet, unless the carpet's been replaced, it's still there. And the outside, your house has been scraped and painted over and over again, so it's laying in the dirt. And I had a child in my practice, a patient of mine, who every spring her blood lead level went up. She got out and played in the sunshine, vitamin D, and our body. And when our body's looking for calcium, it'll grab. It gets kind of confused and thinks lead's kind of calcium too. So you get outside in the spring, the sun's shining, vitamin D level goes up. You absorb more calcium, you absorb more lead too, and her blood lead level went up. So it's not the problem that we're getting into extreme lead toxicity with the increased intracranial pressure in that. It's just that we'd like to get lead down to zero if we can. So, do your best to, fix your environment if you have to. We've come a long ways with lead disappearing from paint. We've come a long ways with lead disappearing from gas, but there's still lead in our environment. And the other source we have of lead is some of our imported pottery has lead paint on it. Some of our imported toys have leaded paint on them and that sort of stuff. So, if you're going to drink your tea, drink it out of an American-made teapot where there's no lead in. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk with a couple people here. We have someone listening over in Normal and have a question there. Line number one. Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Fine.
All right. I was. I'm interested in juvenile diabetes. I've got a child who's had that for 6 years now. What kind of breakthroughs do you see that are real, not not vaporware, but real breakthroughs coming for diabetics as far as, you know, mechanical pancreas or other treatment plans for type 1s.
You know, I would hope that, I guess two things. Mechanical, I understand the problem with the, you know, we do have the, as you're well aware, we have the insulin pumps now. Boy, it'd sure be nice to tie a apparatus to that that would instantaneously measure blood sugar and make the insulin pump, yeah, so the machine would now measure our blood sugar and know exactly how much insulin to squirt out to inject. The other thing I would dearly, wouldn't it be nice to see a beta cell transplant so you could inject, you know, clone beta cells or donor beta cells, the insulin producing cells of the body, inject it under the skin of a diabetic or inject it into the blood of a diabetic or something like that that would replace the beta cells that the patient's missing. Unfortunately, see any of these things, you know, I haven't heard anything coming that anything's going to come out in the next 6 months or a year, but I think technologically we probably I think those are possible.
Well, I keep hearing about things, but I've been hearing about it for 5 or 6 years.
Yes.
And in the meantime, another year goes by and she's still got, you know, problems with her blood sugar. And it's kind of like, you know, you stop. We thought in 2003, by 2003 they'd have something. Then we thought by 2005 they'd have something. And now I'm not hearing hardly anything. And it's making me wonder if the hope is diminishing or if it's delayed for 10 more years. You know, what's going on? And I just wondered if you knew, like, with the Edmonton protocol, what's happened to that, or the Animas optical blood, you know, analyzer.
Yeah.
Those types of things, are they really going to happen, or are they dead, or what's happened?
No, you know what? I think it's just not newsworthy at the moment. No, I'm sure the research is going on quietly. I think it just, you know, bird flu's hit the news. This doesn't seem to be newsworthy right now. You know, I mean, yeah, I think the media is just not going to say, you know, let's talk about diabetes, and guess what? We don't have anything to say except keep your hopes up because it's going to happen. And you know what? I'm sure it's going to happen. For two reasons. I think there's enough people that care about diabetes. There's enough people that have diabetes. It's going to happen.
Well,
I don't know when.
I hope so. But when you're sitting here looking with the problem, you know, she had a crash this morning, and
okay,
you know, it's a very real problem, and it's just a news story that never seemed to come to pass. And when I contact the companies, they're very tight-lipped. They won't say a word, you know. So I thought maybe you would. How do you find out?
When it happens, you will know. They will shout it from the mountaintops. But I think until it happens, I think what I want you to take away from this is they're working on it. It will happen.
Well, like,
but I don't know when.
Last year, they said that they had 500 people testing in Philadelphia with the Animas, you know, that blood analyzer.
Mm-hmm.
It shoots the light wave through the artery, and
yes,
then it refracts the light wave based on blood sugar levels. They had 500 test cases in that, and I thought, man, if they've got 500 people testing, they must be on the brink of. And then you can't get any new information from them.
You know, it may be in phase two now. So maybe they're doing with 5,000. Or maybe there was a problem. And it's gone back to step one again. But they'll keep working on it, and I'm sure it will happen.
Well, that's one of my number one prayer requests, I'll tell you.
Yeah, because there's enough type 1 diabetics out there, and we certainly are hearing more and more about obesity and type 2 diabetes in this country.
Yeah, that's really a different disease, isn't it?
It's a different disease, but some of those folks are on insulin, too, so they need to, well, all of them need to monitor their blood sugars, and some of those folks end up on insulin, too, so a lot of them are sort of type 1 diabetics, if you will. You know, they need insulin.
Because their body's so resistant?
Yes.
Yeah, I could see. Well, thank you for answering my questions as much as you can. And
Well, maybe what we should do here on the program is to go looking for someone to talk with about. I think it's probably it'd be a good thing to talk about diabetes, and maybe we could find someone who would be able to talk about what the state of the art of the research is. So maybe we could find someone, and we can do that.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
We have several other callers here, and I don't know if we can get them all in, but we'll see what we can do. Sheldon, Illinois, is next on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I have a quick question about respiratory infection in kids. My kids get a common head cold, and their nose turns green pretty quick. And I was just curious. I heard there were studies that giving them antibiotics for ear infections were just the same as if you were not to. They would get better just at the same rate of recovery there. Is that a truth? Is antibiotics for that necessary, or do you just wait out the green nose and let the cold run its course?
Okay. No, you wait out the green nose and let the cold run its course. A green nose means that you're several days into the cold. Actually, you're in the recovery phase already. So antibiotics are not – yeah. The green nose does not mean there's a secondary bacterial infection. It does not mean antibiotics are necessary.
Great. That's what I've been doing.
Yeah.
And it seems to – All right.
Now, an ear infection is different. An ear infection, ow, my ear hurts, I can't sleep, I've got a fever, that may deserve an antibiotic. Although, yeah, recently the, yeah, it may not. Some, about 50% of the, I think it's about 50% of the ear infections will go away if you don't treat them with an antibiotic. Some of the bacteria seem to be like some of the bacteria, one of the common bacteria that causes ear infections is kind of like a lemming. It lives for 2 or 3 days and then it just kind of drops dead and the ear infection goes away.
When you head into the pediatrician's office and he said, oh, yes, the ear's red and this is like day 4 of symptoms of your child, you know, having not necessarily high fever or major complaints, but you bring them in because their nose is green. Now, just because their ear appears red doesn't necessarily mean it's an ear infection, does it?
Yes, it does. Probably. If the ear is red and bulging, those are classic signs of an ear infection. But I think what we're saying now is if your child's not – yeah – don't treat an ear infection just because it's there. If the child is not complaining of that ear hurting, or in a child who can't complain if they don't have a fever and don't seem ill with it, maybe that's one you can just sit on and watch and don't treat that with an antibiotic and it will go away by itself.
That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Let's try number 2, line number 2. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could say something about aluminum. I'm prompted to ask because I'm cleaning out a house with a lot of reasonably valuable cookware that's aluminum. And I know the association with Alzheimer's, but I don't know too much about its microelement involvement.
You know, gee, I really don't either. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Don't worry.
I know there was talk about toxicity of aluminum, and I can't remember the exact toxicity in kids with who use some of the antacids that contain aluminum. I'll have to look that one up.
And, you know, just not all that long ago here on the program, I talked with somebody who was with the Alzheimer's Association, and the idea was just a general kind of conversation about what we know about Alzheimer's now. And several callers into the program asked this question about aluminum, and several times the guest said there is no research to show that there is any connection between aluminum and Alzheimer's disease. So if you want to that's what the guy said. If you want to trust them, I guess then that would mean it would be okay to use the aluminum cookware. But it's something that had been certainly reported in the past, and it seems to be one of those things that everybody knows. They say, oh yeah, you know, aluminum. That's what the guy said. He said there was no research to show that there is any connection between aluminum and Alzheimer's disease.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You know, I think, well, even mercury, if you want to swallow pure metallic mercury, go ahead, because chances are it's going to go through your gastrointestinal tract and come out the other side and going to be perfectly fine. It's the mercuric oxide. There's no doubt about it. Mercury is a toxin, but it's got to be in the oxide or we won't absorb it. So pure metal is okay. And I think the same thing for aluminum. If you use the aluminum hydroxide and that sort of stuff, you may absorb it. And I know there is some toxicity with acute toxicity with aluminum. Again, not a chronic toxicity, not ingesting it now and getting Alzheimer's
later.
So, yeah, use your aluminum cookware because it is not oxidized. It is the pure metal, and I think you're going to absorb little or none of it.
Okay. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Myself, I'm sticking with stainless steel, but...
As long as it has no hot spots so you don't burn your...
Exactly. Well, we're close to the point here that we're going to have to finish up. I think maybe I'll have to apologize. We have one caller we can't take. Any last little thing that you'd like to leave with folks before we go?
No. Just enjoy your kids. Enjoy life. It's good, and enjoy today. It's sunny.
All right. Very good. Our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He is a pediatrician, and he's with us once a month here on the show, always on a Thursday, and we talk about children's health. And thank you very much for being here, and we appreciate it.